The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening. On Friday, I heard a story about a newlywed couple who decided to go traveling as their honeymoon to South America. And they were, a week after their wedding, they were driving on a bus in somewhat rural Colombia when the bus was held up at gunpoint. And everything that they had was taken from them except the clothes they had with them. And one person on the bus was shot, kind of a native Colombian, and left on the side of the road. And they were allowed to go at some point with the bus. And at some point they were dropped off at a small town with nothing, no passport, no money, nothing but their clothes. And so the man decided to hitchhike to a larger town to see about getting some help. And the woman was left behind and sitting in a courtyard, and turned out she had something in her back pocket. She had a little notebook and a pencil. So she sat down with a notebook and the pencil, and she said, "I was kind of a secretary because I started hearing this voice and I just wrote it down." And this is what was written down. There's more part of the story. So when they got off the bus, they were looking apparently quite dazed. Imagine something like that happening. And there was a man who noticed that they were in distress and apparently was very supportive, very kind. I don't know, exactly what he did for them, but his kindness was quite a powerful balm for them at that time. And so then she sat in the courtyard, and this is what she wrote. "Before you know what kindness it really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go. So you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how you must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore, only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread, only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, 'It is I you have been looking for,' and then goes with you everywhere like a shadow or a friend." I'm sure many of you have heard that poem. Apparently in 2018, it was the most quoted poem in the United States or somewhere. And it's by a Palestinian-American named Naomi Shahib Nye. And that was her experience. And So, but and the person who was telling the story on Friday, I think he was a little bit misquoting it because maybe he's steeped in Buddhism. He said, before you can know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know suffering as the other deepest thing. And the poem says sorrow. And so that's quite a powerful idea, that there can be these two things inside. One maybe in some ways depends on the other. I certainly have been, and I know people who have experienced great challenges, and it was so deeply meaningful to be touched by other people, their compassion or their kindness, their support, in a way that wouldn't have carried the same depth of meaning if I was just happy-go-lucky going around my day as if nothing special was happening. And so, the depth inside of our capacity for sorrow and for suffering, for a loss, and Naomi Shahib Nye, she lost everything on the bus except her clothes and her little notebook to write the poem on. And to lose everything, and that opens up or touches something, or a tenderness, a hurt, a sorrow, that maybe allows for something different to come and touch us. So I heard the poem on Friday and I read it today, and it made me wonder what lives inside of us, what lives inside of me, and what is it to plumb into the depth, to reach deep inside and touch what's in there. And if we touch the depth inside of us, what do we find? Some of us would like to just find enlightenment and love and just all this wonderful stuff, but is that all that's there? And what's the role of touching what's inside and it being suffering, sorrow, loss, the challenges of life? And to touch that in such a way that it opens a possibility of something much deeper. Maybe these two go together. Thich Nhat Hanh, he's written about a little poem or whatever, a little saying that without mud, no Buddha. No mud, no Buddha. So the mud is kind of the mud of the world, the dirt of the world, the complications of the world. And without that, there's no awakening up, as if awakening or freedom or the path of Buddhism is not divorced from this world. It arises out of it. And here in Redwood City, very few of us have a saying, no garbage, no Buddha. And the reason for that is that some of you driven down Highway 101 Redwood City, if you're driving south on your right, there's the Buddha looking at you. You see, even though you should have been between Whipple and Woodside Road, about a third of the way down, I think, going south, there's this big Buddha that looks down on the freeway. It's an 8-foot-tall Buddha. And we should go visit the Buddha someday, to go into the, get off and find it, in the parking lot. He sits there in the parking lot. And he sits on top of a big cinder block built little room, like a shed or something, but cinder blocks, with a big open entryway on one side. It's probably 8x8 or 10x10 or something. And the Buddha is probably 8 foot tall. He's seated, his cross-legged, and so it's a pretty big Buddha, And underneath that, in that cinder block shed, or whatever, I don't know what to call it, is one of those really big rolling garbage cans. The Buddha is sitting on garbage in Redwood City. Isn't that great? Looking on a freeway. I went down to see the Buddha a few weeks ago, and it was a beautiful day, with beautiful, beautiful blue sky with beautiful fluffy white clouds. And I got up there close to the Buddha, climbed up on that cinder block thing, and I was looking up at the sky, not looking at the freeway, and looking at, wow, You know, it's this big mind, clouds in the sky floating by. It was spectacular. And then I kind of looked at the Buddha. Then I walked around to the back of the Buddha and looked over his shoulder and looks down upon Highway 101 and all the cars driving by. The juxtaposition of the big, empty, sky-like mind and the freeway was quite something. And the juxtaposition of the Buddha and the garbage was quite something. I think there's something profound about it. So that's why in Redwood City, no garbage, no Buddha. So this polarity, or this things working together. So I want to tell you another story, and this is a fable or a myth of Buddhism. And the way I'd like to tell the story, there's two main characters in the story. I'd like to suggest that we listen to the story as if the two characters are really one person. Maybe the two characters are you, and two aspects of you, or two aspects of a single person. And rather than thinking of it as just two different people who are interacting, it's really two sides of one person that's meeting and finding their way together. So, it's a gruesomely violent piece of story, parts of it. When my son was in first grade, no, kindergarten, in first grade, I think it was kindergarten, the teachers would teach stories from Hans Christian Andersen stories, these, you know, fables. And some of them were really violent. And I thought, wow, what are they doing telling this to our kids? And the pedagogical theory was that the kids process, if it's only verbal, the kids take it in just to the degree to which they can understand it. It's not a problem for them. It kind of teaches some kind of morality or teaching or something. So I don't know if that's true, but maybe it's true. Maybe it'll be true for us as I go through this story. So it's a story of the Buddha and Angulimala. Now on that occasion, there was a bandit in the realm of King Pasenadi of Kosala named Angulimala, who was murderous, bloody-handed, given to blows and violence, merciless to living beings. Villages, towns, and districts were laid waste by him. He was constantly murdering people, and he wore their fingers as a garland. And Angulimala means, mala means like a necklace, and Angula means finger. So that's the end of the gruesome part. So now you can relax. So then that morning, the Buddha went off for alms. And he was walking along, and the people said, don't go on that road, to the Buddha. On that road is the bandit Angulimala, who is murderous, bloody-handed, given to blows and violence, merciless in living beings. He's constantly murdering people. Men have come along this road in groups of 10, 20, 30, and even 40, but still they have fallen into Angulimala's hands. When this was said, the Buddha went on in silence. He took that road anyway. And the people kept saying the same thing to him. Many different people said, don't go there, don't go there, don't go there. But the Buddha went on in silence. So here we have two sides. We have the extreme side of a murderer and this man who, religious man, who walks on in silence towards the danger. It's an interesting idea to walk towards what's difficult, to walk towards what's challenging. Maybe walk towards what we don't want to admit about ourselves. The bandit Angulimala saw the Blessed One coming in the distance. When he saw him, he thought, it's wonderful. It's marvelous. Men have come along this road in groups of 10, 20, 30, even 40, but still they have fallen into my hands. And now this recluse comes, alone, unaccompanied, as if driven by fate. Why shouldn't I take this recluse's life? He sees easy picking. Angulimala then took up his sword and his shield, buckled on his bow and quiver, and followed close behind the Buddha. Then the Blessed One performed such a feat of supernormal power that the bandit Angulimala, though walking as fast as he could not catch up with the Blessed One, who was walking at his normal pace. Then the bandit Angulimala thought, "It is marvelous, it is wonderful. Formerly I could catch up even with a swift elephant and seize it. I could catch up even with a swift horse and seize it. I could catch up even with a swift chariot and seize it. I could catch up even with a swift deer and seize it. But now that I'm walking as fast as I can, I cannot catch up with this recluse who is walking at his normal pace." So then Angulimala stopped and he called out to the Buddha, "Stop, recluse. Stop, recluse." Angulimala kept walking, but he said back to Angulimala, "I have stopped. You should stop too." Then the bandit Angulimala thought, "These recluses speak truth, assert truth. But though this recluse is still walking, he says, 'I have stopped. You stop too.' Suppose I question this recluse." So he's going to question him rather than kill him. Then the bandit Angulimala addressed the Blessed One in the following verse. "While you are walking, recluse, you tell me you have stopped. But now when I have stopped, you say, 'I have not stopped.' I ask you now, O recluse, about the meaning. How is it that you have stopped and I have not?" The Buddha said, "Angulimala, I have stopped forever. I abstain from violence towards living beings. But you have no restraint towards things that live. That is why I have stopped and you have not." And then Angulimala says this, "Oh, at long last this recluse, a venerated sage, has come to this great forest for my sake. Having heard your verse teaching me the Dhamma, I will indeed renounce evil forever." So saying, the bandit took his sword and weapons and flung them in a gaping chasm's pit. The bandit worshipped the Buddha at the Buddha's feet and then and there asked for going forth as a monk. The Buddha, the sage of great compassion, the teacher of the world with all its gods, addressed him with these words, "Come, Bhikkhu." And that is how he came to be a monk. So that's the beginning of the story. And I'll skip a whole part of it. But then, so he becomes a monk, Angulimala, and he becomes enlightened, in spite of the fact of all the terrible things he did. Then when it was morning, the Venerable Angulimala, dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe, went to town for alms. Now on that occasion, someone threw a clod and hit the Venerable Angulimala's body. Someone else threw a stick and hit his body, and someone else threw a pot shred and hit his body. People remembered his past, right? Then with blood running down his cut head and with his bowl broken and his outer robe torn, the Venerable Angulimala went to the Buddha. The Buddha saw him coming in the distance and told Angulimala, bear it. You are experiencing here and now the results of deeds because of which you might have been tortured in hell for many years, for many hundreds of years, for many thousands of years." So it's a little bit, it's a myth, right, or a little fable. So if you try to argue the logic of it. But the idea is that he still, even though he did terrible things, he still has to experience the repercussions of what he did, but they're not going to be as bad as they were going to be, because where he was going to be was going to be reborn in hell. But now he's freed of hell because he's enlightened. But he still, in this world, has to live the repercussions of his past actions, and people are throwing things at him and cutting him. So that's the story. And that story gets told a lot in Buddhism, and in India, back in the ancient times, there's many versions of the story that are told. It was popular by storytellers, and they would embellish it in different ways and fill it with different teachings so that were being expressed in different values. And in our tradition, we have just this version here. And it's another time, I don't know if I'll ever teach this, but one of the primary themes that runs through the story is the speaking of the truth. So even though it's about this murderer and the Buddha, it's kind of a fable that keeps pointing back to what is true and speaking what's true. And you see that in the beginning where the Buddha literally doesn't say what's true. It's figuratively true. He says, I've stopped, even though he keeps walking, but you haven't. But what if we see this as being different aspects of one person? I don't know if you want to look at it yourself, not that you're murderers, but maybe you have some minor foibles in there. And you have also in you the Buddha. You have that part of you that's capable of walking on in silence towards the danger. That part of you that doesn't get afraid by the other part of you. The part of you that can be wise and can address the part of you that's not wise. The part of you that is at peace, that can somehow meet and touch the part of you that is at war, is troubled, in turmoil, in conflict. So these two sides. You cannot know that kindness is the deepest thing inside until you know that sorrow is the other deepest thing. So what happens if we interpret this story metaphorically this way about ourselves, and there's two sides of ourselves that can meet and work it out, or somehow the wisdom side has something to teach, something to offer to that part of us that's troubled or challenged. So what happens then? What do you think? What are your thoughts now about this story? And what comments do you have about it? And how is it useful to interpret the story this way as being a fable about two sides of ourselves? So if you could use the mic up there on the stage.
Is the mic right on the corner of the stage?
You have to push the button that's in the middle of it.
Okay, yes, okay. So what I found the most interesting was, I think I definitely see myself in times experiencing and accepting kindness when it's both offered by me, but also when I can receive it. Yeah. And the same thing with, I guess, suffering in the story. Like, I feel those things separately, but what was hard for me to connect in the story was, like, when they come face to face, there's very few times where, like, I'm in a situation where I see kindness and suffering at the same time, and I'm trying to experience them in kind of a coexisting sort of way. I think I see that in other people a lot when they're struggling with kind of bringing kindness into a situation that they're suffering in their lives. But it's so hard for me to reflect in like my own light, bringing those two things together in one. I know it happens very often, but I never really recognize moments when I see that.
Especially in the complexity of daily life and what goes on. But has there ever been an occasion in your life, maybe a rare special time, when you actually felt you could approximate that or do that?
When I could, like, see them together?
Yeah.
I guess, like, yeah, like a time, like, I guess more recently when, like, this has happened was I lost, like, a really, really close friend, like, that I've had since I was, like, 6 months old. Like, we were best friends for a really long time. And we got in one altercation where, like, I guess we both just kind of dropped it and, like, walked away. And I think for the longest time I was really suffering and I was really focusing on that one friend. And I was letting a lot of other friendships go because I was letting it really consume me because I was suffering. And I realized that I was losing a lot of, like, kindness or, like, two of my friends that, like, really were there for me and, like, deserved it. So I think there was, like, a moment recently where it came face to face. And my mom said, you're focusing on the one red light when there's a line of greens. And she's like, you need to bring those, like, greens to the red light and let them meet each other so that, like, you can overcome the red light.
Great. Beautiful.
So, yeah, that was my mom's advice. She's the one that kind of made me see it. But, yeah, I think that was more recently when I started to be more kind to my friends and to the people in my life. Great. Because I realized I lost my one chance with her.
Great. Thank you. So you can do it. So the idea is now to kind of grow it. Someone else.
Okay, is this better? Okay. I was thinking about the big scary guy who is murdering and is never sated, right? There's always more people to murder and more things to do and more things to kill in more gruesome ways. And for me personally, it resonated with do not take that which is not freely given. So let's say I want an apology from someone who's not ready to apologize. Or maybe shouldn't even apologize, right? And I keep seeking that. They may have stopped, but I'm continuing at a speed that will never be sated. And that's an example from my life. And when I let go of a hurt, a deep hurt, where I felt completely righteous, right? And I let things settle and see the truth of what was there, I did end up getting an apology because I stopped. So I see it as you cannot catch up to this stillness if you're voraciously trying to, get resolution, right? Which is endless devouring.
So we have to stop sometime.
Got to stop sometime. Uh-huh.
So meditation is one of those ways we learn to stop. Thank you.
So with the theme of the two aspects existing in yourself, I see a big part of it is being kind to yourself when you discover the nasty stuff in yourself.
So for you, you're saying sometimes if you learn to be kind and compassionate, then maybe it's possible to discover some of the nasty stuff?
More than that, it's... I often catch myself being angry at myself for doing some blunder, just something in the kitchen or how I dealt with somebody or something like that. And it's sort of charity begins at home by being kind to myself.
Nice. Very, very nice. Thank you. Jim, over there by the entryway.
I found interesting the last part of the story as well.
A little bit closer.
I found interesting the last part of the story as well. That I know for me, at least in the beginning of the journey, there was this idea of, okay, there is like this enlightenment thing, and you achieve it, and it's kind of like a checkpoint. Okay, everything is good now and forever. But at least for me so far, it's been more like... So what I'm referring to is that like last part of the story where he's... That murderer person is living the world as a monk, and there are still like people who, in less maybe skillful ways, try to resolve their own emotions towards this person. And to me, it kind of resonates with like, yeah, there are some deep insights that I uncover about myself, but it's not like all these neurological pathways in me are just like now forever gone. There are still some cleansing to be done. There is still, like, I can feel blissed, content, and peaceful, like, right now in the moment. Mm-hmm. There will still be times where I'll be back in the whatever other states I can come across. And it's just the constant process rather than a checkpoint.
So it's not that we just flip a switch and we suddenly go to become the Buddha and now we're kind to forever, but we still have all these other old habits, old forces that keep coming sometimes. And so the idea of bear it, we have to practice with it. We have to learn to hold it without getting caught by it and without picking up the violence again. Is that a little bit what you're saying? Yeah. So the bear it is also another way of saying stay present. Stay with what's here. Stay present. And so a little bit, for me, this end of the story is that we have to also be willing to experience the repercussions of what we've done, the consequences, and live with them. And so you're pointing out some of those consequences are the continued challenges we find inside of ourselves. And so how do we sit still with that, and how do we treat that with kindness, and as opposed to think we're all or nothing? I think one of the nice things for me about interpreting this story this way is that it's a little bit of a medicine to the illness of seeing ourselves all or nothing. You know, thinking we're supposed to be all good or seeing ourselves as all bad. But, you know, these two live inside of us to some degree. No mud, no Buddha, no garbage, no Buddha. You know, what's in there? And how do we have the two meet and work together? How do we see the parts of us that are challenging, the sorrow, the suffering, the tendency towards anger or violence or fear or whatever it might be? And how can we bring the Buddha inside of us to meet that and to hold that? And maybe not completely transform it, but maybe begin changing it in ways that transforms it from a bandit to a monastic. That's quite a change. What would that look like inside of you to allow that transformation? One of the remarkable things that mindfulness can teach is that when people have a lot of fear, many people have anxiety, and unless the anxiety is a little bit, you know, too strong, one of the great tasks that mindfulness does, that practice does, and it's whether it's explicit or not, it's kind of this movement that we're trying to help our fear feel safe. Have you ever thought of, you ever tried doing that with your fear? Help your fear feel safe? Sometimes fear, we don't like it, we're pushing it away, we're trying to fix it, we're trying to avoid it, we're trying to cover it over, or you know, you do all these things to it. But this poor fear doesn't feel very happy if it's being attacked or fixed or, you know. And you know, the fear, probably what it needs is to be left alone and feel safe. And then it's kind of like a fist that if you hold it, support it, it will open up. So if you can hold the fear with kindness and help it feel safe, that's your job. That's the Buddha's job, to help the fear feels safe, then it can relax, and then it goes away. And that's a very different movement than fixing it, or pushing it away, or letting it go, or something like that. And so what about tendencies towards anger or violence? Maybe the same thing. Or what about the deep sorrows that we carry with us? I've gone through a lot of sorrow, and this practice has been phenomenal, to hold the sorrow. And for that, I like a different image. I like the image of cupping my hands together like a little nest or something, and then imagining my awareness as those is like that, and I hold the sorrow, and just hold it. It's, again, so it feels safe, so it's allowed to be, and then just let it be and see what goes on. So in that sense, the cupped awareness, the cupped hands, is the Buddha holding Angulimala. You know, I've stopped. And I hold what is still active and moving. And so many of the things that are still challenging for us are moving and running and chasing and trying to escape and agitated. And to be able to meet that with a still heart or with a still mind or with a still hands, and to be able to help it feel safe and to understand that you're safe with it. Because it goes in both directions. I think one of the reasons people are so reactive to the inner challenges they have is they don't feel safe with them. They feel identified with them, or they feel like it casts a bad light on themselves, or it's going to get the upper hand, or it's going to, somehow it's just a bad thing to be this way. But to be able to sit still in meditation, it's a great laboratory, it's a great discovery zone. To be able to sit still and feel all the challenges we have and realize that we're safe with them. We make ourselves safe for them. We're safe by being non-reactive, not doing anything with it, not identifying with it, just holding it and being present. And we make it safe for them. And don't underestimate the power of making it safe for them, whatever the difficulties are inside. And part of the power is that what's inside, that's what's difficult, it wants to resolve itself. There's a self-healing and self-liberating movement inside of us. We don't have to be in charge of the fixing. We don't have to be in charge of the healing or the liberation. We're in charge of meeting it. And that's why I like this story so much of the Buddha. He goes towards the danger, towards Angulimala, but then he goes in silence. That's what he tells the villagers. He just walks on in silence. And then he just kind of steadily doesn't change his pace. He just keeps walking. And he's not threatening to Angulimala. And he's not afraid of Angulimala. And Angulimala has no way to catch him. So how can you make yourself that way? Maybe start in meditation. How can you steadily walk forward, step by step, with your awareness, with your presence, and be a person who's safe for all the things that are inside, but keep walking, keep being present in such a way that you don't have to be afraid of anything that's inside. Wouldn't that be marvelous? If you had nothing to fear of all the shenanigans that go on in there? And what happens when these two meet this way? And that's, you know, metaphorically, I think one of the things we try to do in meditation is we're taking the, you know, to use fancy language, we're taking the Buddha mind and using the Buddha mind to meet the Angulimala mind or the difficult mind or whatever it might be. And so what is your Buddha mind? What is the mind of awareness or the mind of stillness or the mind that doesn't have to be afraid, that doesn't have to attack, doesn't have to judge or criticize or make anything a problem, but in fact stays present, really, or goes towards it even, what's there. And maybe it goes towards the difficulty inside in order to hold it in its cupped hands. Maybe it goes towards what's difficult inside and say, I see you and you're safe right now. Maybe it's to go towards what's inside and offer kindness to it. Or maybe it's to go to what's difficult inside and get curious. And curious about, where is this going to go? How will this unravel? What is it? What wants to happen here? And to have the humility or the not knowing mind that you don't really know why you have all these challenges. But maybe if you have this Buddha mind that holds it, you'll find out that it has an important function. And the function maybe is to show you kindness, compassion, or maybe to show you freedom. So Angulimala story. So now if you ever hear the story again, you might listen to it from this perspective. These are two sides of the same person. And then that saves us all from a lot of protests about, you know, this story is a crazy story. You know, how could this be? So, any last comments? We have 5 minutes. Any last comments anyone wants to make about the story or my interpretation of it? Or yes. So we have, where's the mic? Here.
So I found myself spending a lot of time with my heart on my chest, or just, you know, stroking my arm or something, just kind of to tell myself that, oh yeah, this is okay. I can hold this, and also, yeah, this hurts, and, or yeah, I did this thing, whatever it is, and really just to really hold it, really physically, externally, as well as whatever's going on inside. And it's been really nourishing to really be able to hold all of that.
That's, I think, a very wise thing to do. And as you feel nourished by it and feel the nourishment and the healing from it, at some point when it feels right to you, because you're following your intuition with this, when it feels right, do that holding yourself with kindness this way, physically and all that. Do it lighter and lighter. And as it feels right. Because sometimes when people do what you do, they sometimes remember the strength in which we did it at the beginning and think that has to always be that way. But as it does its medicine on you, it actually becomes more and more nourishing the lighter you do it. Okay, so may your Angulimala and your Buddha walk hand in hand. Thank you.